Great trial lawyers are made, not born. Welcome to Verdict Academy, preserving trial wisdom for trial lawyers. Join host Kevin Morrison, trial attorney in San Francisco, as he recreates those invaluable hallway conversations that remote work has made rare. Candid insights and hard-won lessons from America's most accomplished trial lawyers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Verdict Academy. I am pleased, honored to have one of my good buddies and outstanding trial attorney, Walter M. Yoka, a.k.a. Wally Yoka, as known to his colleagues and friends. Wally is the founding partner of Yoka Smith in Los Angeles, and I believe you just celebrated your 30th anniversary. Did you know that, Wally?
Well.
Yeah. I missed that invite. I'm still checking my spam folder. I'm sure it's there somewhere. Wally is a nationally recognized trial attorney, primarily defending products, cases, commercial disputes, class actions, and serious catastrophic personal injury wrongful death cases. He is recognized by his peers and major invite-only organizations such as the American Board of Trial Advocates, where not only is he a member of that organization, but he is a leader as well. He is president of the Los Angeles chapter. He was president of Cal ABOTA, which consists of all the California chapters of ABOTA plus Hawaii. He's a member of the American College of Trial Lawyers. He's a member of the International Society of Barristers. I mention those organizations because those are invitation only. You have to be asked to join by your peers after a significant vetting process. Wally also, not only is Wally an excellent trial attorney, but he practices at the highest level of civility, and that's demonstrated by two awards. He got the LA ABOTA Civility Award, which we consider in San Francisco our highest award, the Civility Award. I'm sure it's the same in Los Angeles. Also, the LA County Bar Association honored you with their Civility Award, as I understand it. So he's served on a number of blue ribbon panels by Chief Justice Ron George. Too many to mention. He went to Cal State LA, which I think is super cool. I want to talk a little bit about that, and then graduate from Southwestern Law, where he's recognized as the Alumnus of the Year in 2018. Please welcome Wally Yoka to Verdict Academy. Thanks for joining us, Wally.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Wow, what a great career. How did you decide you want to be a trial lawyer?
You know, that's not the first time somebody's asked me that question, so I have the same answer. I always just wanted to be a trial lawyer. I'm not sure I know why. I think I was talkative as a kid. And I was an only child, and my parents just let me talk whenever I wanted to talk. And I think they found me entertaining, truthfully.
So you always knew it was in your blood. You knew as a kid you wanted to do that.
There's no doubt. And so when I went to law school, I mean, law school was just a means to an end for me. I started law clerking I was going full time to law school, and I started law clerking in my second year. And I just fell in love with the practice, and I couldn't wait to get out of law school.
Now, did you know you wanted to be a trial lawyer, or you just wanted to be?
I did.
You did.
And I was very lucky to have been embraced by a great trial lawyer, a guy by the name of William Marshall Morgan and Morgan Wenzel and McNicholas, a well-known trial firm that unfortunately is no longer with us. But he was a spectacular trial lawyer, and I just fell into it. Really, just luck. Walked into my office one day and asked me to do a job on a case, and I did it, and he liked it, and then he just took me everywhere.
Was that your first job as a lawyer, working with him?
First job as a lawyer. And when the firm imploded, that's when we started Yoka Smith.
Wow. So you've basically been at two firms your career.
Exactly.
Yeah. You've had great mentoring then.
Great mentoring.
So how many times did you get to second chair or attend trial with your mentor before you got cut loose and did your own thing?
Really good question. I want to say I tried maybe 10 to 12 cases with him.
Wow.
And a variety of cases. I mean, from representing the Hare Krishnas to representing insurance companies in bad faith cases. I mean, a remarkable set of cases that just totally opened up my eyes to being a trial lawyer.
Yeah. Mentoring is so critical. I know you've returned the favor with a lot of partners in your firm. And I know you're very involved with ABOTA. I know Chris Faenza, obviously, Alice Smith and others. I'm sure you do a great job getting them a lot of trial experience and have.
I do think, and I'm only going to take part credit on that. I think my partners really are just spectacular at that. And I think that's a big thing we do. So right now, both Alice and Chris are in trial with associates.
Two different cases.
Well,
okay. That's fantastic. And so you're giving the youths an opportunity to get into court and see what trial's like.
And we have three women ABOTA members, and we're very close to having a fourth. And if, I guess I would include Judge Lauren Lofton, who was with our firm. She became an ABOTA member when she was here at our firm. So I think we take a lot of pride in that.
Yeah, and you should. Trial's becoming a lost art, isn't it? Fewer cases are trying. It's more expensive to try cases. There's so much pressure, alternative dispute resolution. Judges look at you like, well, how dare you come to my courtroom and clog it up with a trial? There's an attitude sometimes with that. So it's hard. It can be difficult to get folks out to trial, can it?
It can. And it's remarkable sometimes how many judges don't seem to like lawyers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Why do you want to be a judge if you really don't like the company of lawyers?
Exactly.
But that's a whole nother story. So
I got an issue with judges who don't like make decisions, I think. Isn't there one of their things they should be doing?
The other thing, like lawyers and be decisive. That's all we can ask for, you know?
Well, mentoring is a perfect segue in what we're doing, because the purpose of this podcast, Verdict Academy, Wally, is, as you know, there's less and less, fewer people going to trial, less in-office interaction, because work from home is so pervasive, certainly in the Bay Area. I'm not sure, it's probably less so in Los Angeles, but there's fewer opportunities for younger lawyers to, quote, bump into the senior partner at the water cooler, the proverbial in the chat. So what we're trying to do with this podcast is give younger lawyers tips from the preeminent trial lawyers in the country, and you are certainly among those, as to what things, you know, the critical things they should be doing at trial. And I know that we talked a little offline, and one of the things you want to talk about is you need to look at each case differently in terms of one part of a trial might be important for a certain type of case, but another aspect of trial might be important for another kind of case. Did I summarize that correctly?
You did.
Expand on that a little bit, Wally.
Yeah, I think it's just important, particularly for young lawyers, to just embrace the notion that one shoe doesn't fit all, right? Every case is different. There's no single solution or single approach for every case. You have to take each case individually. You're a storyteller, ultimately. So how, when you tell that story and in the context of where you tell that story could be different in every trial. So staying away from kind of a formulaic approach is a good thing, because I think it makes you nimble. And ultimately, a good trial lawyer is nimble. And so I just think it gives you that kind of freedom a bit in cases. So shall I give you an example?
Yes, please.
Okay. So let me just kind of start with a voir dire. So, you know, a lot of lawyers will say, and I don't necessarily disagree, but a lot of lawyers will say that voir dire is the most important part of the case. And it may be. And it may not be. Now, when I say it may not be, it doesn't mean that you ought to just give it a once over.
Take the first 12 of the box and pass.
Yeah. Your job is to pick what you think to be the best jurors for your case. And so that obviously is as important as anything you might do. But all that said, so stipulated, there are some cases where sometimes voir dire has an increased importance. Okay, so I was trying a case a number of years ago. I was representing a tire manufacturer, as I'm wont to do. It was a 20-year-old used tire that was installed the day before the accident. And that was as strong of a narrative for a products case as you might have. And so I wanted to get that narrative out in front of the jury right away. So I kind of felt like voir dire was kind of a key to kind of laying that in such a way that it will always be with the jurors, no matter what happened during the trial, right? They would always take that, they would take that home with. So the plaintiff's lawyer went first and found a juror who not only bought used tires, but liked them, okay? So I thought, and I saw a couple of the jurors kind of squint a little bit, like, you know, really? So I went right after that juror. As soon as the plaintiff's lawyer was done, the first thing I did is I went to the juror and I said, so I understand you like used tires. Oh, yeah. And I said, let me just ask you this question. How many used tires have you bought in the last, let's just say, year? And he says, oh, maybe 5 or 6 tires. And I said, well, for how many vehicles? Well, just one vehicle. You think I'm making this up? It's a true story. I said, so these used tires, no, they don't last very long. No, they don't last very. And I said, did it ever occur to you that it might be a little dangerous? He said, yeah, you know, it is a little dangerous, but I don't mind. No problem. You don't mind. So I tell that story because that made voir dire the most important part of that case.
Yeah. And even if that jury didn't make it on the panel, the rest of the panel heard what he was talking about.
It didn't matter. Yeah. That's right. So another example, I'm representing a manufacturer of a pipe on a tanker truck, and the pipe exploded, caused awful injuries to the truck driver. And I knew that the plaintiff was going to get some leverage on the case against me because of something called porosity. The pipe had, if you magnified the pipe to an nth degree, you would see a bunch of holes in the pipe. And so I thought that could kind of ring with the jury a little bit. But my case really, I felt, is strong as it could be on causation, that you couldn't have made a pipe strong enough to withstand the pressures that ultimately built up in the system, which were not my client's fault. It was another defendant's fault. So I knew that the causation, and as you know, causation can be a little difficult for a jury to understand. So I felt like I needed somebody on the panel who was, let's just say, smart. And I kept a lawyer on the panel. And when I did voir dire, I kind of focused on this lawyer. And I won the case. I lost on defect, and I won on causation 9-3. And it was because that lawyer went back in the jury room and explained to everybody what causation was. So I would tell young lawyers, you know, as an example, that, you know, some things in a trial are more important than others, and you have to seize that opportunity. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely makes sense. Absolutely makes sense. Let's talk about, so you talked a little bit about voir dire and what you did in voir dire, and how do you establish your case narrative? Are you of the opinion that you're up there just trying to get your bad facts out and getting those people off for cause? You know, you want to build credibility, of course, but are you also trying to get your case narratives out? That's a lot to do up there when you're talking to a whole bunch of new people for the first time. How do you balance those competing interests, Wally?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the answer is, you know, yes, I want to try to get out the best and the worst of my case. And what I try to do typically is I try to find one juror who I'm watching, listening, maybe the way they've answered questions, maybe their experience, maybe there's something in their background that will allow me to engage in that give and take. And I'll use that juror to do that. And then I'll loop in everybody after. So I'll say, you know, did you hear juror number 6 here or Mrs. Smith? And she said X, Y, and Z. How do you feel about it? Do you feel differently than she does about it? How about you? How do you feel? That's typically how I would do kind of a looping exercise.
Totally makes sense. You want to talk to all the jurors at some point.
Exactly.
And then, I mean, getting your narrative out was a beautiful example in the tire case because you had a juror volunteer that information, which is just, that's a gift, right? It's a gift. Sometimes you don't have anybody with life experience that's in the issues in the case. Will you introduce it then in voir dire and test that?
Yeah, I will. And I also think, you know, and this is consistent with cross-examination as well. That example I gave on the tire voir dire, it didn't really matter what he said, right? If you think about it. You know, if he said, no, I think used tires are perfect, they're not dangerous, no problem, no problem. And on the other hand, if he went the way I thought he was going to go, it was basically say, yeah, I know I'm taking a risk. So on that, as you know, that's the same with examining a witness. You know, the ultimate cross-examination question is, it doesn't matter what the answer is. Both answers are good for you.
That's right. Absolutely. You got to be sure that whatever the answer is, you can use it. It doesn't matter which way they go. 100%. In terms of voir dire, are you a fan of questionnaires, those in advance or not? And if so, why or why not?
The answer is yes, I'm fine with it, particularly if you're using a consultant. My only thing about questionnaires is for them to have value, you got to give me the chance to read them. And so, as you know, some judges, they'll use a questionnaire and then you get the questionnaire like a half an hour before everybody's rifling through them. So I try to make sure, and can't remember a time that I had a problem with my opponent on trying to get the judge to agree to give us, if you're going to give us the questionnaires in the morning, let us pick the jury in the afternoon. If you're going to give us the questionnaires in the afternoon, let us pick the jury the next morning. and our pitch is, this is going to make the process go fast, smooth. So I don't have a problem with it. Over the years, you know, I think when I first started using them, they were much more detailed, much more case specific. I think I do less now. I think I try not to overdo it in the questionnaires.
When you're picking a jury, you've got people at the table taking notes, I'm assuming. Is that right?
Yes.
I'm guessing you're a guy who doesn't use the podium. You get in front of the box and talk to folks. Is that generally your style?
I like to move around. Sometimes I'll use the podium. Sometimes I'll move away from the podium. I kind of go around a bit, but I guess I anchor a little bit at the podium, but I try to not dock.
Yeah, 100%. You'll be chained to the podium. And do you take notes when yourself, a couple of notes, or just zero notes? You rely on your folks at the table to do that?
That's a good question. Sometimes I pretend like I'm taking notes. I guess I rely more on it. I just think that you have to establish a conversation. You know, the moment as a trial lawyer that you feel as comfortable talking to a jury as you do talking to your friends in the living room of your house is the moment you become a trial lawyer.
Yeah. If you had a favorite part of trial, you had to pick one part. You can only do one part of trial. Which one would you do?
Oh, man. I do like expert cross-examination. And, you know, it can be, depending on your case. For example, let me give you an opening example, okay? So let's say that you think that your win-loss is going to be driven on your ability to take apart your opponent's expert, okay? And let's say you've got a lot. Let's say there's a lot.
You've got a lot of ammo against him is what you're saying.
Exactly. And so, you know, in opening, you know, you sometimes have to make this decision about how much do you try your case in opening. And sometimes what I've done is, for example, if I know that my opponent's going to call their expert early in their case, sometimes I'll use the opening to do my first cross-examination of their expert. In effect, I will get very aggressive in my opening against their expert. And so when the jury first hears direct exam of the expert, they immediately already have heard me. You know, they've already heard me cross-examine the expert. And so that gives me kind of a first shot, if you will. So I like doing that, depending upon the case. And so what I'm doing is laying the groundwork immediately, and then I just start playing off of it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, answers the question. Opening statement, some of you are very critical, depending on what studies you read. I'm sure you read all this stuff. 60% of folks are leaning one way or the other after opening, something like that. How important is opening, and how do you decide whether you're going to go after them or just kind of, you know, just keep in mind, folks, that we get to go and keep an open mind and listen to our case too, kind of a thing.
Well, again, like we started at the beginning of our conversation, it's each case is driven by what you're trying to accomplish and where you think your assets are and where your liabilities are, right? So I guess I would say you always want to be careful not to overplay your hand, number one, because if you don't deliver on your promises, you'll get eaten up in closing, right? And your opponent will have gotten a transcript of the opening and will have a very lovely PowerPoint done by a very sophisticated technical person and will put it up in closing argument, and the jury will see that you didn't deliver on your promises. And so that then puts your credibility at issue. So you got to be careful. If you're going to get out there on your opening, you better be prepared to deliver it. I also sometimes think that you can use the opening to, the other thing you got to be careful about is if you're not sure that piece of evidence is going to come in, you got to be careful. And it's sometimes better to err on the side of not talking about that piece of evidence, because then if it comes in, then it's like, bang, you know, it's really good. The other thing I would say is that you just have to be careful about not overdoing it. And I'm not saying that you don't do what you need to do to tell your story, but you just have to be careful. I think just like in opening and closing is particularly from a defense lawyer, you can never demand that a jury do anything. You know, you have to ask. I think that holds more true for defense lawyers than it does plaintiff's lawyers. That's my opinion. Maybe people can disagree with me. When you represent corporate America, you can't make demands. You know, you have to ask. And I remember I learned that lesson in a I've only tried one plaintiff's case, okay? And I lost this plaintiff's case, and it taught me that this was not something I should be doing. And I felt so strongly about my case, and I felt that this defense lawyer was so misrepresenting what was going on in the case, and I felt like I just kind of got over my skis. And I went back after I lost the case, and I went into William Marshall Morgan's office, and I said, I lost. And he said, okay. He said, well, tell me about what happened. And I'm explaining. And he goes, well, I know why you lost. You didn't ask. You demanded. That was kind of a good lesson, I thought.
I hear what you're saying. I want to ask a little question about that, because I'm curious. As a plaintiff's lawyer, my thought on this, my philosophy is that the jury's looking to you, for example, to tell them what the case is worth, because they have no idea what the case is worth. And they think that you damn well better know what the case is worth, because you're the lawyer up there with the gray hair. So my philosophy is, I know what the case is worth. I'm going to say in a nice way, but I'm saying this is what the case is worth, affirmatively said it, as opposed to, well, you guys do what you want to do, and here's a range. That's my philosophy. But tell me where you think that might be an error.
Yeah, that's a good question. I've done, as you would imagine, every which way but loose on that. I think that if you really lay it out strongly what you think the case is worth, I think it's all about your delivery of it, and I think it's all about the credibility that you've established with the jury. Because if you're firm on it, then they'll respect that. But I get what you're saying. If you're too loosey-goosey on it, then that won't deliver either. So I think it's about establishing, as a plaintiff's lawyer, establishing your credibility with the jury, and they respect your firmness and your sincerity in saying that this is what this case is worth for this person, you know? I mean, I've seen it work, seen it not work. And you know, in today's world, no amount that's too much, okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
No offense.
No offense. Look, we're having an open conversation. Yeah. Verdicts are going up. People are asking for money, money that would have been jaw-dropping 10 years ago, right? And now, without a blink of an eye, jurors are saying they got no problem with that number. Has that been your experience?
Not as much as some.
Sure. I'm not suggesting you're getting hammered. But when I'm saying in jury selection, you're floating these huge numbers. You know, back in the day, there would be like, oh my gosh, you're going to come across as a pig. And now, a lot of times, well, geez, you got to ask for a full value, and that's your job.
I think that's it. I think that there is a kind of unbounded kind of a philosophy on the other side. And, you know, when it works, it works. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, the overreach has, you know, kind of a negative consequence, particularly if there was some overreaching on other things going on in the case.
100%. No, like, you have to have credibility. You have to absolutely, your plaintiff has to be able to deliver, and you have to have a super clean case, and you have to give them a reason why the case is worth what you think. There's this methodology. It's not just taking something out of thin air, right?
Exactly.
The last thing I want to talk about is embracing the negative. I call that judo law, taking their force and using it in yours. Tell me, how do you embrace, you know, occasionally you'll come across as a defense lawyer with a bad fact or two. Who knows? You don't want to hide that from them. But tell me, how do you embrace the negative when you got a bad fact that you know is coming in?
This is kind of my thing. I really strongly believe in this idea of embracing the negative, because you can't run from it. And if you run from it, you'll be seen as running from it. And if you're scared of it, then the jury is going to place greater significance on it, right? So you just have to face up to that reality. So, for example, in my world, you know, you'll frequently encounter bad documents. You know, somebody writes a memo that you think to yourself, I can't believe this guy wrote this memo, right? So the plaintiff's lawyer loves the document, and we'll put it up on the screen and, you know, make a huge deal of it. What I do is, as soon as I get up to do my redirect or whatever, I'll immediately put the document back up. And every time he or she shows the document, I show it again. I show it as much as I possibly can. And I'm doing that because my hope is that the jury finally says, okay, we've seen enough of it. What else do you have? Anything else? You know, we don't want to see it anymore. I also think you need to embrace these sorts of things because, for example, what if you have a documents in a case where you have people, engineers, for example, doing self-critical analysis, right? So they're questioning how this design is working, whether they ought to change this design, yada, 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 Okay. Not unusual. Documents produced in the case, the plaintiff sees the documents, and all of a sudden they have a defect theory because now there's engineers at the company saying that maybe the thing should be designed this way rather than that way. This way becomes the defect theory. So you've, in effect, given the plaintiff's lawyer in this document the defect theory. They may not have had it before they had the document. This is not unusual, as you know. So what I like to do with those kinds of things is I like to approach it this way. It's not companies that have these documents that you need to worry about. It's companies that don't have these documents that you need to worry about. Because we enable people to do self-critical analysis, to challenge themselves, because we're all about doing the best job we can.
I love that. That's great. I've never thought of that before. I've never seen that done before.
Yeah. And that's all that is embracing the negative. You know, it's making something that your opponent thinks is your negative into your positive.
What kind of company would we be if we didn't continually try to get better?
Isn't that what you expect of us?
Love it.
So if you have design changes, of course we have design changes.
Yeah, every product develops over time.
Does anybody surprise? Would you want to buy a product that's never had a design change? Buy a product that's using engineering and technology from 30 years ago?
It's great. Great example of embracing the negative. Love it. That's fantastic. Well, unsurprisingly, the 30 minutes flew by, but I want to give you a final shot here at our audience. Any final words of wisdom that you want to convey to our younger trial attorneys to keep using that muscle to exercise the Seventh Amendment, which is so important for us, Wally?
I would say work hard and have fun. That's what I would say. That's always tell my kids. Work hard and have a lot of fun. Have as much fun as you have hard work.
Love it. Well, you love your job. You love your career. I know I love mine, you love yours, and it's a blessing to have a profession where we love coming to work, isn't it? It's a blessing. I know many people, unfortunately, don't have that blessing, but we certainly have. Thank you, Wally Yoka, for being a guest on Verdict Academy. I really appreciate this. I could talk to you all day long. It's a blast with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Thank you for listening to Verdict Academy. If today's insights resonated with you, please subscribe and share with colleagues. In a world where we see each other less, learning from experienced trial lawyers matters now more than ever. Join us next time. Produced and powered by LawPods.